I'm Wayne.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Stargate Pioneer from the Starling Tribune.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 122 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we have come to the realization that the work we did about 20 episodes ago was by far the epitome of our podcast's quality and content. So from now on, we are going to hold everything to that precise standard, and if we can't recreate that in exacting detail, we are just going to bitch and moan about it until the vast majority of you just stop listening. So the rest of you can just get off our lawn. I am Keir here in the GPR studios this evening. Joining me, as always, my co-host and partner in time, Jay. How are you, sir?
You know, every episode that we've done that ends in 7 is just complete crap. We need to stop doing those.
All right, yeah, just get rid of the 7s. It's just the number is verboten. Mm. And over there in the corner, slightly hacking up a lung, is Haley. How you feeling, Haley?
The 7s are my favorite. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
It's just, you know, there's one in every bunch. What the hell are we doing tonight?
Well, this week we're going to talk about the different factions in the Doctor Who fandom and the problems that some of the more zealous ones can cause. Is this a healthy banter among the fans of a show that has run this long, or harmful fractures in the show's support? Does the bickering stimulate the conversation and a fuller appreciation of the program, or only serve to keep people with a common interest apart? Grab your bulletproof vests, because tonight, everything is under fire.
You have failed this show. Wait, sorry.
No, that's my other podcast. Come on.
Damn it.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that we've all noticed is that Whovians are physically incapable of coming to a consensus. It's just not going to happen. There is no way of doing it. And we're okay with that. You know, it gives us a very diverse fan base, and you know, there's always room for discussion, and it's a lot of fun, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, the Doctor Who fandom is such a great part to be a part of. But there are some in every bunch that decide to spoil it for other people, and these are the ones that take their fandom so incredibly seriously, and everything outside of my purview is wrong, and you know, it originally, when we first started discussing this, it was basically just the old Whovians versus the new Whovians. You know, and the disparaging between the two of them and things like that. But as we went on, as we started going through and breaking it down, we realized that there's far more to it than just that. There are factions all over the place, and some of them, you know, are, you know, relegated to the classic series, and some are relegated to, but then there's some that kind of pick and choose from between the two, and it's mm-hmm. very interesting to see how it all works out.
Yeah. They could be based on era. They could be based on your primary doctor. They could be factions that revolve around a single character and your opinion of a single character, supporting character at that. So, I guess one of the things that we've been trying to figure out, as Jay mentioned, there's really no kumbaya, everybody get along solution to the entire set. But I guess the discussion is more a matter of, is it something that needs to be solved, or is it just something that needs to have the view shifted just enough so that it's constructive rather than destructive?
Yeah, and you know, some of these are simple oversights by the fans. It's just a matter of like, wow, I did not realize that this was an issue, or I did not realize that this existed, or something like that. But then there's others where they take an active stance on, no, if you're not doing this, then you're wrong, and I'm going to make sure that everyone converts to my way of thinking. And those are the ones that are really the problem. But yeah, there's, well, so our first example are the classic diehards. The people who, you know, they were fans of, you know, Troughton or Pertwee or wherever it was that they came in or were born or wherever. And, you know, the show existed and it was fantastic. And at the end of it, that was it. Nothing else existed after that. You know, 2005 never happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys are few and far between. There's not a lot of these people, but they do exist.
Is that because they're dying off?
Well, yeah.
but we hear from the ones that do exist, so we know they're out there.
But, I mean, these are the kind of people that if you go up and you start to talk to them and you bring up something from the new series, instantly it's a wall goes up. You know, they start tearing it apart and they start telling you why you're wrong. And it's just, no, that's not the right way. And it was better here. And, the conversation almost stops.
Right. And they'll have different ways of going about it, whether they start attacking the nature of the program changes, the format, the average age of cast members, or any of the things that have taken a shift from, you know, pre-RTD, post-RTD, that they decide they're going to latch on to. And it's really not, as far as I see it, it's really not so much taking anything away for the adoration and the love that they have for the show that they endeared themselves to from their stance, mm-hmm. because that's absolutely admirable. And, you know, they want to be, I think to a certain degree, kind of recognized as the torchbearers for all that time. Even as the show started to stumble and was on its last legs, they still stayed true to it. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely commendable, respectable, the shoulders of giants you stand upon, or however you want to look at it. But this is a show built on change.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally, literally.
And we're talking about the literal definition of literally, not the figurative definition of literally.
Correct. The premise on which the show functions, that everything is in a state of flux, and the changes have to be, if they cannot be predicted, they have to at least be dealt with as they are handed to you. Mm-hmm. So if the fan base can't behave the same way that the characters in the universe are asked to, that's a disparity.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem that this causes is the fact that, you know, anyone that has said, I came to the show with Eccleston or Tennant or Matt Smith, you've run into someone that, you know, when you say that, they kind of go, oh, you're one of them. You know, and it makes you feel like you're not a good enough fan of the show because you didn't know it existed before then. And it causes that rift of no, we're the Doctor Who fans. You're part of this group over here. Go sit at that table with the other nerds. We're going to
the
sit over here.
The kiddie table.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And it is very much a senior junior kind of dissension.
Right. So, you know, this is one of those things where you have to understand that, you know, as Kira was saying, the show is built on change and the fan base is going to change as well. You know, like we said before, some are going to, you know, we'll say regenerate. You know, and new fans are going to come in all the time, and it's never going to be the same thing. And that, as much as I might hate the book and everything that it stands for, the if anyone has ever read the book, Who Took My Cheese or whatever it was, that's basically how it goes. It's like, you know, understand that change is going to happen and just enjoy it. Don't try and fight against it because it's futile.
Right. Well, I mean, this is, and we're going to get to the next sort of the rift or the next break is very similar, and it's going to kind of hinge on this, but it goes along with the whole idea of you have a story that is being told over the course of 5 decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to look at this as one long tale in the life of our Time Lord, and unless you want to have something that is I'm going to use a really bad pun here, that is time locked, so that you just keep getting the same. But you know what I mean? I mean, the same characters, the same instances, the same threats, the same solutions, the same path, the same course, over and over and over again, with slight variations in the backdrop. Then you are going to lose your viewership very quickly.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things we've always said, is that that's one of the reasons, or that is the reason why this show has lasted for 50 years, because it changes, because it has a mechanic built into it that says when things start to get tired and boring and everybody knows what's happening, we just flip it and it can be a completely different thing. And that helps keep it going.
Well, I want to take something there, because you're talking about if it's the tired, the boring, the same thing, or a formula or a pattern starts to emerge, those could be all happening at the same time. It could just be one of those elements. You know, people may argue that by the time we got to the close of series 7, we had something kind of compelling because we, you know, came into Time of the Doctor. Yes, I do know that even among the fan base, Time of the Doctor, and Jay, cover your ears for a second, I was reading so many negative reviews about Time of the Doctor as being viewed from both classic Whovian standpoints and what it didn't do to honor the true legacy of the show. And I saw some bashing on Time of the Doctor from New Whovians, who felt that it was lingering and dwelling on things that it didn't need to at the expense of a decent story. So, you know, again, you're never going to satisfy everyone. And even within the people who are so, you know, admittedly in love with the program that they, you know, they memorize scripts and they attend cons and they cosplay and they discuss it at work, whether there's anyone else there to discuss it with or not, and on and on. But you can't satisfy everyone, even when you try to put a production together that says, look at everything that we've done and everywhere we're headed. Mm-hmm. If that's what that anniversary episode or you know, mini film was, even there, you're not going to be able to satisfy everyone. So, you know, mm-hmm. can you just accept the fact that this is something that is being done to adapt, to open the door for the next change? Because I wouldn't say that Series 7 was necessarily boring, but maybe the big shift that going into Series 8 was because of the formula starting to make itself apparent.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, and that was the reason for the turning everything on its head. And for those people who don't really like or click with where the Capaldi era is at the moment, give it another half a season to settle in or find a way to take its next logical step, because it's going to change as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but as far as, you know, looking at this, and Jay, I want to let you tee up the next facet of this particular battle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the story has to move along. So rather than something... I'm trying to think of examples here. Oh, okay. All right. Literary example. And I happen to love them to death. The Series of Unfortunate Events.
Right.
Okay. For youth fiction. Great premise. David Handler, Lemony Snicket, you know, coming up with these books. They are formulaic as hell. I mean, literally, you just, you know, you've got an instance where the kids are in trouble. Count Olaf does something. They use all of their individual resources for their strengths, along with whatever relative or friend has survived, and get themselves out of it towards the end. And Count Olaf runs off into the distance. Even in those, by the time you got to the last couple of books, they got even darker, even more twisted, and it was a matter of, you know, fans were saying, well, my children are going to be disturbed by this. No, they're not, because they've come along with this series knowing that these are unhappy stories where the characters get pissed on regularly, and yet they triumph.
Mm-hmm.
How they go about it is what changes as they mature with the book. Harry Potter series. Same thing.
Yeah.
Felt a little formulaic, but the stories got more complex. The characters got more complex. Things changed dramatically. We lost a few characters. It has to evolve.
Yeah. But that brings us to our second group and taking things kind of to the extreme there. The, what I like to call the old guard. These are the classic fans that, you know, they, because it was written down or because it was in an episode, it is law. This is final. You cannot move past this. These are the ones that, you know, they're known for statements like, well, because of episode, you know, 12 in season 46, they clearly reference the use of the soup ladle of Rassilon as a steering mechanism. I cannot accept being used to serve soup.
Right. You
know, and they're so caught up in the canon that they can't accept, you know, any change because, you know, they have to go and they have to cross-reference and they have to check and they have to make sure that it doesn't interact with anything else in any way. And it's, and they can't appreciate the story that's laid in front of them because they're too busy paying attention to what happened, you know, 26 years ago.
Well, any show, any film series, any literary series that goes on for more than, you know, a couple of installments is going to run the risk of having this portion of their fan base, I think. Because, oh, yeah. The you know, you set a couple things in motion and you still want to tell a compelling story a couple of episodes or a couple of seasons or a couple of books later, and you're going to have people who nitpick the fact that there's conflicts in, mm-hmm. in some things that you have set in motion previously.
No, and that's fine. I mean, that's honestly, I love doing that. I love, like, you know, getting references to something earlier on or seeing how it plays out. I mean, you know, one of the greatest jokes that I remember on television is from Community, where they took 3 years to set up a simple Beetlejuice gag, you know, and it's little things like that make me enjoy being a fan of a show. you know, when they can treat me intelligently enough to say, hey, you know what, you're going to get this. But there comes a point when it's like, you know, when you have this much material, you're not always going to be able to, you know, mesh everything that somebody wrote back in 1965 with things that they're writing today. You know, it's something is going to get lost in translation or something like that. And it's just, you know, they may have made a huge mistake by referencing something back then that, you know, it has created havoc throughout the whole, you know, show today. So it's one of those things you have to understand that things aren't always going to line up. Things aren't always going to be perfect. And it doesn't ruin the show when that happens. You know, just because, you know, one doctor calls it Metabolus and the other one calls it Metabilis, it doesn't mean that the show is being ruined.
Right. It's just that one of them is completely wrong and broke the show.
So what they need to do is go the Marvel route and number a different universe.
Exactly. Every doctor is technically from a different universe. But these are the kind of fans that create the problem, because that means somebody coming in says, oh, I want to watch this show, but there's 51 years of story here that I would have to get caught up on to be able to understand this, because these people pointed every little detail. So clearly they're important. And it makes the history of the show become an obstacle instead of a draw.
Yeah, I know you tend to refer to them as the old guard. I sort of see this as this is a continuity police kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's really just a matter of, you know, no, that can't possibly be because X, Y, Z. To a certain degree, there's a part of me that appreciates the fact that there are people out there so committed to the finer details that this stuff ruffles their feathers, you know. Kudos to you for being that on point about the minutia, because it just shows how much you absolutely love the material. But mm-hmm. to the same degree, I'd like to see you try and generate anywhere close to a small percentage of the volume of material that has generated out of this universe that has to go through at least certain degrees of BBC approval along the way, and try and not trip on a continuity landmine, you know, now and then. I guess it's just a matter of, is it worth it? Is it worth pushing back from the table because of the, you know, the mispronunciation of a planetoid, or the, you know, the erroneous reference to an obscure weapon that was never actually seen in a previous episode? It was only described. And now when you see it, it doesn't match the description visually.
Yeah.
You know, or something of that nature. Is it worth it?
I mean, there are instances where this happens that are absolutely worth, you know, throwing a red flag on. You know, like, you know, a little squidgy bit on the TARDIS, making sure that you can fly it telepathically. Or, I don't know, using something like a sonic screwdriver to cure cancer. It's there are times where it's like, no, this is too far. You're crossing the line here. But then there's others where it's just like, you know, if you can just look past it, it's a great episode and it's not going to bother you.
So. Or there's just going to be a certain degree of it where the other 99% or however, you know, however you want to break it out of the viewing public kind of lets them stand on their soapbox a bit, you know, and say their piece. And then when they step down, you pat them on the head and you congratulate them for knowing as much as they know and you walk on.
Yeah. Oh, so then the next faction that we've got, how do we want to title these people?
did they ever actually have a name for their clique?
Not that I'm aware of, but we're talking about, we'll say maybe like and I don't want to limit it here, we're just using the term, it doesn't necessarily pertain to just females, but like the Tennant fangirls, or the Rose 10 shippers, or, you know, the people that fall into that, and you know the group that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. These are the ones where, you know, the show begins and ends with season 2, or, you know, even up to like season 4. These are the people that, you know, Doctor Who was built around David Tennant, and nothing beyond him could ever remotely be possibly anywhere near as good.
The Bad Wolf Pack.
There you go.
I like that. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and it's, this is one of the ones that tends to get a little bit more rabid, because they have, I guess you could say that they've got fortresses and distribution centers, Tumblr, that allow them to just, you know, kind of throw their propaganda and their rhetoric out there. I'm not really sure what the benefit is. I mean, the problem that they cause is obviously, you know, it's just a matter of dissension and people made to feel, you know, belittled or beleaguered because they don't happen to think, oh, well, David Tennant's a, you know, he made a wonderful doctor. He's mm-hmm. not my personal doctor. How could he not be your doctor? How could that possibly be? Well, I don't know. I like the way that he worked with Donna. Yeah, but he and Donna were never going to have Time Lord babies. What?
Yeah.
You're not in on the headcanon, so I guess you're just wrong.
I guess so. I don't know. But okay, so what is the... is there a possible solution to a group that tends to put on blinders, so to speak, when it comes to this? Because their stance is really a matter of they feel that period, you know, call it 2 to 3.5 or so, or 2 to close of 4, was the peak of what the show should be. It was snappy. It was humorous. It had action. It had romance. It had unrequited love that then sort of got a little bit requited. But then it was love lost, and it was tragic. And so you have Romeo and Juliet and all these things tied together. And everything else that is not within that bubble just falls short. They may not, some of them may not call it, you know, worthless or go to those extremes, but they don't want to hear about it because it doesn't carry with what they felt was the gold ring of the show standard.
Yeah, honestly, I've thought about this and I've had discussion with people and granted there are a few of these that are like, no, I understand you have a different opinion. It's wrong, but you're okay. You have a different opinion. And, you know, it's, they don't get so, you know, so vehement about it. It's, you know, they can have a conversation. And those are the people that, you know, when you get to the point where you realize, hey, you know what? We have different opinions and we're both fans of the shows. I'd say that's, you know, equilibrium right there. As long as you can reach that point, everything else is okay. But then you've got those that, you know, they just refuse to recant. And with those, the only thing you can really do is pull up Netflix on your phone, flip to Doomsday real quick, show it to them. And once they crumple to a sobbing heap on the floor, you walk away.
Just a suggestion. Would it be worth? Do you think that there's a certain subsection within this subsection that doesn't really look beyond that period because they just don't see the point in doing so? Maybe they benefit from. I mean, Tennant's gone on record. There are, you know, interviews and YouTube clips and things out there where he talks about his love for the show past. Mm-hmm. That may encourage them to see some of the benefits because if their, you know, floppy-haired Jesus is a wavy-haired Jesus is endorsing, you know, the Peter Davison era mm-hmm. or something of that sort, then that may encourage them to go back and see what it is that he enjoys as a gateway.
Yeah, maybe? I mean that's a possibility. Yeah, it's I don't know, the ones that I've always run into seem to be very aware of David Tennant's, you know, fandom and everything, and that kind of feeds their fervor for some reason, but they refuse to move past it. I mean, I'm sure there are some out there that might be oblivious to it and might be able to, you know, you might be able to use that as a jumping off point, but I don't know. It's definitely worth a shot.
Well, hopefully at least they're still, you know, boosting Broadchurch's numbers.
Yeah, hopefully.
Or Penny Dreadful, for those of you who are still following Billy Piper around. That's almost, it's due to come back in a week or two, right?
I stopped paying attention once she wasn't on, you know, Diary of a Call Girl or whatever.
Fine.
Yeah, I'm talking to you, Sole. So what's the next one that we've got here?
Well, this is the individuals who fall. We talked about some of the old guard and folks that were the champions for the classic series. So now we've got those on the opposite side who are, I want to say don't even acknowledge that the classic series existed. As far as they know, Doctor Who has been around since 2005, which means that Christopher Eccleston was the first Doctor.
Yeah.
David Tennant was second Doctor. But my personal favorite is the third Doctor, Matt Smith.
I've had this conversation before. I've you know, wearing my TARDIS jersey out or something, and somebody catches me, and they're like, oh, that's great, and we start the conversation, and I'm like, you know, so who's your Doctor? And they're like, oh, I really like the third Doctor. And I'm like, really? That you're a fan of Pertwee? And they're like, who's that? I like Matt Smith. And that's the point where I'm just, you know, whether I can do it physically or not, mentally, my hand smacks my forehead and I turn around and walk off. Yeah. It's, It's one of those things where you're just, you can't help but be like, really, are you kidding me?
I'm going to say this is probably one of the least harmful groups because it's just a matter of lack of information. You know, maybe they're just, I only know about the show because of what came up on Netflix. And as far as Netflix says, this is season one and this.
Right.
Well, I feel like this is really two groups. There's the just ignorant. They don't know that there's others. And then there's the willfully ignorant in there that are like, well, there was this other stuff before, but it's dumb and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, certain French podcasters on the Gunna Geek Network don't fall into that one at all, no.
I don't know who you mean.
He loves this Dr. Who show.
Well, I think when it comes to that, if we can safely say that the folks that just haven't been exposed to the larger scope, that's an easy fix. Mm-hmm. And they can choose to watch or they can choose to walk away, and that's absolutely fine too. Some people it's just not their cup of tea because it is a very different program. And that's okay. But from what Haley's referring to about saying they're the ones who look back, see what there was on the other side of the wall there, and then decide to throw bags of dog poo over the wall, because it's just clearly not only was it something that they don't want to watch, they want to actually discourage other people from watching because they think it's going to ruin people's opinion of the show in general. Mm. That's toxic.
Yeah, that absolutely is. And that, you know, granted, there are episodes in the classic series that we'd all rather forget. I mean, look back to our Pollyanna arc last year where we brought some of them out of the mothballs, but you know, if you go up and tell someone, hey, you know what? You should really watch Time Lash. You're not doing them any favors.
No.
But if you go and tell them, you know what? You can just skip City of Death and Caves of Androzani and all that. No, just skip it because it's useless. That's even worse.
Well, you're denying someone's, you know, personal take and subjectivity on programming that may appeal to them. You know, they may be Douglas Adams fans, so they may absolutely love City of Death because of its pace and its wit and so forth. But you've told them to walk past it because the picture quality is kind of crap and they used synthesizers for their score rather than a full orchestra or whatever it is about the nature of it that
it's
just doesn't.
Before there was color in the world.
Right. Everything was kind of bland. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know that there's necessarily a solution for that other than common courtesy. Just a matter of just recognizing, you know, the individuality of the viewer and their personal take on it. And I guess that you could say that about any of these groups, but this one in particular just seems one where it's willfully attempting to white out or retcon the vast majority of this show's legacy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of leads us into our final one here that we've got. I had this as a separate entry here, but when I look back over it, this really is almost an all-encompassing thing, because you can put every one of the ones that we've talked about already into this one. And that's the, you're a bad fan. You know, these are the people who, you know, who tell you that you're doing it wrong. You know, you can't say that you love Tom Baker if you haven't seen Legopolis, or you should hate Matt Smith because he's childish and goofy. And, you know, they're the ones that tell you how you're supposed to enjoy the show and why you're wrong for doing it the way you do.
Mm. Right. You're supposed to start by watching An Unearthly Child, go all the way through, and then the Fourth Doctor is supposed to be your favorite because that's just the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's kind of common sense, but yes. Right. It's not.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. Every once in a while, I found that over the past year or so, I've gone back because they're very quick and I can just kind of, you know, have them going in the background while I'm doing something else around the house. And I'll grab one of the Doctor's Revisited intro segments, you know, those 18 to 20 minute little pieces that they put together during the anniversary year.
Right.
And I'll have them kind of going back there. And one of the things that I always liked about them, and I know we've commented on this a lot, was because of the fact that it was, even when they were discussing some of the classic era Doctors, they were doing so with interviews from writers, producers, actors, current cast members, looking back on them. And then by the time they got to discussing the modern era, the post-2005 Doctors, there were even some instances there where you had cast and crew members from previous era looking forward and saying, yeah, I could see so much of Patrick in what Matt Smith has been doing, you know, and things of that sort. So you get to see the viewpoints from those in the thick of it pointed in all directions, and it sort of rounded out the appreciation, which I'm sure is exactly what they were intending to do with these productions. But as far as those individuals who sit there and say, well, clearly, you know, if you don't know that, you know, you have to, you know, Betsy was first seen in this episode and wasn't fully a recurring character by John Pertwee's acceptance and wanting to keep classic vehicles on the set, and getting into those aspects of it, if those individuals are going to be so island centric about their appreciation for the show, I would argue that if you feel like you're being bombarded or influenced, or at least someone is attempting to sway you in one direction or another like this, and you're kind of questioning it, if it doesn't feel quite right or what have you, this is kind of like, you know, what's a good analogy for this? It's the peer pressure that I would have to say, you know what, step back, get a higher altitude view of this, and recognize the fact that there are people who are just as passionate about the alternative viewpoints, or in direct contrast to what that other individual is trying to tell you has to be done. Mm-hmm. It's the you know, doctor second opinion sort of thing. Oh, I'm loving that pun. I gotta write that one down. But that same individual, like you said, that, you know, you're discussing the fact that, oh, well, you know, you can't possibly consider yourself an appreciator of Tom Baker unless you can, you know, unless you look back and do a script line by line read of Logopolis or what have you. Mm-hmm. There will be the same individuals who say, you know what, that, you know, I actually didn't like that particular story. But I really appreciate this one over here, and I liked it better because it allowed Baker and his companion to do such and such and such. And they can itemize it with just as much vehemence. I think that is one of the best antidotes, because you don't have to agree with either one of them.
Yeah.
But just the fact that you see that there are people sitting on both sides of the fence just tells you, oh, okay, this is a personal decision. So yeah. I don't have to feel like I have to side with anyone or I have to go about this anyway. You know, when we did the episodes about primers, getting into either the show in general, mm-hmm. or classic or any of the individual doctors, you know, we kept prefacing this as this was just our call.
Yeah,
we did cursory views on some of these things and decided that for us personally, if we were trying to sit somebody down, this is the way we'd go about it. But your mileage may vary.
Right, right. You know, honestly, what this kind of reminds me of is, as you were talking about it, it came to mind, is my oldest son and his best friend, for some reason, decided that they needed to be able to argue about trucks. So one of them is like, oh no, I like Chevy. And the other one's like, I like Ford. And they constantly went back and forth. And like, anytime they had a chance to like take a pot shot at one of the other ones, like it was this constant arguing and everything. And I finally asked him one day, I was like, all right, what's the torque on a Chevy S10? Okay. What's the payload of a Ford F100 or F150? You know, and I asked them questions like, and neither one of them knew anything about anything beyond it had a bow tie or it had an oval.
Well, you could have started that whole argument with, all right, first of all, both of you gentlemen, show me your driver's license.
I was going to say, no driver's two license? Kids that have never driven a truck, yeah. But yeah.
Have you ever turned the key on one of these vehicles?
But I mean, that's basically what it boils down to, is it's all based on, well, I like this and this is my opinion, so therefore this is the right thing and nobody can dissuade me from it. And that's basically what you're getting at with this, is that it's someone forms their opinion and they pile everything they can into it to back it up and to make it sound reasonable. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually start to show them something contradictory, they shut off. It's like, no, that's not right. I can't counteract it, but that's not right.
Yeah. I think that may be a safe defense for, you know, for anyone who finds themselves either in a water cooler discussion or even, you know, con discussion or something of that sort, where you get, you know, where you're really boiling it down to some of the serious super fans and things, that if you do find that you're in the presence of somebody who is one of these, clique members, mm-hmm. congratulate them, you know, appreciate the fact that they're adamant about how they feel. And they probably want to hear that. Somewhere in there, they want some sort of gratification for the fact that they know as much or are as passionate about whatever their stance is,
yeah,
that they want that recognized. And it's absolutely fine to do so, because they've you know, that is something admirable, because we're so glad that you love that aspect of the show so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then just say, you know, absolutely fantastic. I feel a little differently, but I totally get where you're coming from. I think that's fantastic. I'm going to go look at the vendor's tables for a little while.
So there's two ways to resolve this. One, if you are being accused of being a bad fan and you know, so many words or whatever, the thing to understand is that yes, it is their opinion. You know, you have to keep that in mind, that this is something that they have concocted in their head, that this is something that they're basing all their stuff on. It does not impact the way that the show is for you. There's nothing they can say that's going to change the way that the show makes you feel or your appreciation of the show or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So you have to keep that in mind. And every last one of us is guilty of this to a degree. I know I am. But if you ever find yourself in the situation where you're about to tell someone, no, 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 you are wrong for this, you need to understand that this is your opinion. And this, you have to let people appreciate the show that they will. Because it wasn't your advice that got them into the show. It wasn't you telling them the backstory on these episodes that made them fall in love with Doctor Who. They got there on their own, and nothing you say is going to change what got them there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also rest assured that nothing that they say or do is going to take the show away from you.
Yeah, exactly. And, so, you know, I may want to disagree with people that love Mark Gatiss scripts, but I don't say that they aren't true Doctor Who fans because of it.
You
know?
He just thinks it in his head.
Yes.
And sometimes mutters it under his breath.
Well, but as I'm walking away, I've gotten
writes
better.
It on the back of his
He doesn't say it to his face, out. To their face. He has manners.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Oh, and I'm sure that we've missed some facet of fans in here, and I'm sure everyone has had some interesting incident that they've had with, you know, running into someone that just, you sat there just completely confounded. You know, and we would love to hear some of those stories because let's face it, it's entertaining.
Yeah. Well, we're about to be, you know, elbow deep in quite a bit of it in a couple of weeks. I'm sure we'll be able to recount a few for ourselves after we come back from Galley One. So
absolutely.
But yeah, either instances where you've had to grapple with one of these cliques, or defense mechanisms that you've put in place to be able to handle them, or ways that you've been able to defuse the situation, would be interesting to know too. Because, you know, we don't want to be made to feel uncomfortable about something that we care deeply about, and that we've devoted so much time and energy to viewing and appreciating and immersing ourselves in. So if you found yourself in that sort of situation where someone is, you know, I guess you kind of refer to it, and you meet people like this, whether it's Doctor Who or any other thing that you sort of appreciate, somebody who becomes that energy suck, you know, and you just feel like they're kind of draining you because of negativity or because they're just, you know, they're so so stubborn about a particular standpoint that it's just exhausting trying to sway them or even just placate them. So what do you do in those instances? And we'd love to hear some of your recounts on that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you to Aset and Ben for responding to our call out for feedback, because this actually, especially Ben, your comment really helped to turn this into something different than it originally started out as. So thank you both for your feedback on that.
And for allowing us to go back and check the actual etymology of the British term bugbear.
Yeah, we got a little bit American right there.
Oh, it's a fantasy era thing. Now I get it. You actually have to roll a natural 20 to defeat the bugbear.
It's not funny. I got killed by a bugbear one time.
Once.
Those things are nasty.
My grandfather was killed by a bugbear. How dare you?
Yeah. So next week, we're actually going to just play around with some stuff. We decided to have some fun. And this came around thanks to Badger posting a funny picture. But he teamed up Strax and the Fourth Doctor. And
yeah,
my mind just lit up.
Yeah, the whole premise is, you know, obviously we know that Strax having to serve as the indentured butler at times to the Paternoster gang and threatening people upon entry into their domicile, paired up really nicely with Tom Baker's line from City of Death where he claims that he absolutely loves the butler because he's so violent. So it's a nice little tee up there, sort of in reverse time. So the thought is, if we were to start stirring the pot, so to speak, between doctors and companions or doctors and supporting characters, either beneficially or detrimentally, you know, what would be some of the outcomes of putting certain pairings or groupings together. So, this could get ugly.
Yeah, and so we're just going to throw everything into the blender and see what comes out and see what kind of pairings we can have fun with. So begin thinking now, and we want to hear what kind of pairings you want to have, whether it's doctor and companion or two companions, or, you know, if you just want to see, if you really just want to see the brig running around with Amy, you know, let us know.
No shipping. No, we're not getting into shipping on this one.
No. We'll stay away from that.
Yeah, there'll be another episode for all that.
Not on this podcast, it won't. So we do have a little bit of news.
Are you telling us how we should like Doctor Who?
Damn straight I am. On my podcast, I can do what I want.
Oh, it's his podcast now. Yeah, no, it is. Mark your timestamps.
All right. So we do have a little bit of news. It's been a very slow news week, though. But
well. No, we knew this was going to happen because we're sort of at that trough point between close of one season and the early stages of development on the next, where, you know, if they're doing some principal filming, but there's still a lot of open slots in some of the writing and directing and even casting positions along the way to fill Series 9. But we do have some pretty good news on this.
Yeah.
Regarding Series 9 and the return of someone in the directing chair who has a bit of street cred, as far as it goes.
She did one episode of Doctor Who. You may have missed it at some point. The Doctor wasn't even in it very much. It was something like Blink.
Blanket? Was it Blank? Blanket?
Blanket. Something.
Blanket, yeah.
So Hetty McDonald, who directed the episode Blink, will be returning for an episode in Series 9. So we don't have anything on who the writer is going to be or anything about that. We just know that she will be back for Series 9, and this makes me so happy.
Right. Yes. Because it's not often. I mean, we sort of, when we look at Blink and we think about just the, you know, the nature of the script itself or just the creep factor and that sort of thing, bear in mind that as much as we credit Moffat for his writing and editing down to what we received screened, her craft in terms of envisioning that, you know, you've got someone with the OCD and control freak tendencies of Stephen Moffat, who's turning over a piece like this to someone else's hands to say, I need this envisioned. And we don't often look at a lot of these episodes that way. The directors don't often get, and I'm not really sure why it is that we've done this so often. We tend to look at an episode and succeed or fail, the first thing we do is we look at the writer.
I think it's because we tend to hear from the writers a lot more on Doctor Who than we do the directors.
Possible, yeah. But I think as far as giving credit where credit is due, I think one of the things that we'll probably see quite a bit from McDonald, and I think that's probably because of the way that she works with her photography and cinematography teams, is the look, the angle choices. And even working with the editing team, go back and watch Blink again, you know, if you can bring yourself to watch Blink again. Go back and watch Blink again, and if you can, if you're capable of sort of stepping back and looking at the way it's shot and presented, you know, if you're not paying as much attention to the dialogue and some of that, and just look at the way that it's framed and presented to you, it's really an interesting take. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that from having her back in the chair.
Yeah, absolutely. This is going to be great. I can't wait. Then the other news that we've got is Russell T. Davies, who came out recently and said that he's not going to return to Doctor Who for an episode, apparently spent some time talking about writing a Doctor Who movie.
Well, he kind of implied that he felt it was time, and that, you know, given the opportunity, he'd jump at it because he kind of feels that with everything as successful as it is right now, that there's no way that a big cinema event would not do exceptionally well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's him just feeling a little left out. But he thinks it's something that should have been started yesterday.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And to be honest, I kind of think that he's got a point here. You know, the Day of the Doctor was absolutely brilliant in what it did. And I mean, you know, sold out everywhere, you know, so it clearly there's money to be made there. You know, fans of the show will go and see it over and over again if you do it right. But the thing is if you can also do it at a point where it's a good jumping on point for new people. If you can make it a movie that is standalone, that, you know, people can go and watch it and think, hey, you know what? That was good, and understand everything that's going on throughout it, then, you know, you are opening the doors to so many more people. Mm-hmm. So I don't see, you know, as long as they get the right people behind it, people that care about the IP, people that understand the story, then I don't see any way that this could be a bad idea.
Well, I guess you're always going to have to be concerned about, going back to what we've just been talking about, continuity disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
That's always going to be a concern. There's going to be an issue of the fact that, you know, RTD's era and things that he's put his hands on have a very distinct feel, which may come across slightly jarring if it runs up against still running, still airing, still being produced Moffat episodes and things of that sort.
What I'm saying is that, as I said, you know, if you have the right people behind it, I'm not saying that RTD is the right person behind it. I'm not saying he's wrong, but if you get people behind it that understand all of the consequences of everything and can really make it fit, you know, between companions or something, that would be a great time when you're introducing a new companion. Use the movie to introduce a new companion. Mm-hmm. You know, that way you do have the opportunity to explain to the fans, you know, because that's always one of the best points for, you know, introducing the show to people is when there's a new companion, because you do get the explanation of the TARDIS and the Doctor is an alien and things like that. So you could very easily put that into the story of the movie.
Right. And it would fall obviously between seasons, probably during those longer in between seasons ones where they decide, oh, let's have 2 years between seasons instead of one or whatever.
Right.
Put out a movie.
Hey, maybe when they finally make that shift over to the Sherlock production schedule and just start doing 3 episodes a year.
A year? Jeez.
You just keep your mouth shut, okay?
Yeah, they're going to do 3 90-minute episodes, and then they'll do a fourth, which is a cinematic release.
Yeah, I don't see any way that could fall apart after the first go-round.
I think that's going to go over really well, especially with the American fans.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see if anything does come from this, or if it's just, ironically, a bit of Moffat-splaining from RTD. All right, well, I think that's all that we've got this week. Yep, so this has been episode 122 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, there's really nothing to fight about as long as we can all agree that Mark Gatiss should never write Doctor Who again.
And this is Kier saying, Peter Cushing or die.
And this is Haley saying that everything Kier has ever said is wrong.
We'll see you guys next week.
I can agree with that. That was it.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.